Hi, welcome to Album to Album. I'm Arslan Mohammed, and this is a new series of podcasts presented by me, detailing the albums of David Bowie. I'm a Bowie geek of many years' standing, and in my spare time, a journalist and podcaster living in Berlin. And the idea of this podcast series is pretty simple. I often find myself thinking about Bowie's life and music, and having exhausted the patience of friends and family, I decided to turn to a gang of like-minded people with whom I can open my anorak, not literally, you understand, and talk about David Bowie's albums and the kind of satisfying geeky detail that I really enjoy. I think everyone worth knowing has their own favourite David Bowie album. So I sent out the word to friends, acquaintances, friends of acquaintances, and there came back a surprisingly warm response from pretty much everyone I contacted, apart from one person. But here we are, and here you are, and you made it this far, which is heartening indeed to me. So, to start off our series, I'm very happy to introduce you to the wonderful Nicholas Pegg, the author of the ultimate Bowie reference book, The Complete David Bowie, and a man who knows more about Bowie's life and work than anyone I've ever met. Nick was here today to talk about one of our mutual top Bowie albums, 1969's David Bowie, also called Space Oddity. Now, this is an album I've loved for a long time, rather than just liked out of a sense of duty, Diamond Dogs. Enjoyed in sporadic bursts every few months, Young Americans, pretended to like more than I actually do, Station Station, or loved just so ridiculously I actually moved to the city of its recording just to feel closer to it, Heroes. Space Oddity is a peculiar little album, a mixed up hodgepodge of styles and ideas. At times you feel Bowie's trying on different styles and approaches to see what'll stick, but overall he seems to be going for a sort of psychedelic Dylan feel, especially in tracks like Janine, Signet Committee, and the wonderful Unwashed and Somewhat Slightly Dazed. Overall, the mood is quite downbeat and reflective, which are unusual qualities in a debut album when you think about it. David Bowie was 22 at the time of recording, and was moving on from the fag end of the hippie movement into a fudge of confused Eastern spiritual beliefs. He was smarting over the recent breakup with his girlfriend Hermione Farthingale. His career had been chugging along in first gear for a few years now, to little acclaim, and to top it all off, his father died. He was not a happy astronaut, but this album goes deep into that troubled psyche and plumbs the depths for some truly heartbreaking, revealing songs. And never again, in my opinion, would Bowie write with such candour and openness about himself. So this album really does have a mix of the personal and the universal. This is the counterculture in 1969, seen through the prism of a frustrated, dreaming suburban youth in Bromley. He was thinking big, but he wasn't quite entirely sure how he was going to get big. So let's get to the heart of the matter. Let's now meet Nicholas Pegg and try and find out what makes this album such a corker. I hope you enjoy. This is Space Oddity.
David, the record which you have in charts in Britain at the moment is undoubtedly your biggest success to date, isn't it?
My only success to date.
Well, I wouldn't have said that.
Most people presume that it was written because of or anticipating the space shot, but in fact it was started last November.
Well, this is David Bowie's second album we're going to talk about. Of course, it was originally called David Bowie when it came out in 1969, but his first album was called David Bowie as well, the one 2 years before that.
So it's
confusing. So shall we just call it Space Oddity?
We'll which call it is, Space Oddity.
I know that's wrong for the purists, but it was renamed Space Oddity when it came out in 72, and let's call it Space Oddity. I see this album as a sort of a collection of slightly random snapshots of where David Bowie was at in 1969. You know, it's the work of a young man, 22, at the time that he wrote and performed most of this album, who is at a certain and, you know, at the time, you know, unsuccessful point of his career. He hasn't had a hit yet at all. His first album was released in 67, a fascinating album, actually a slightly more coherent album than this one, though, oddly enough.
It does hang together.
And then there's quite a long gap, you know. He was struggling, he was, you know, lurching from one, you know, he'd already been, you know, dumped by his previous record company, and his manager at the time, Kenneth Pitt, was trying, you know, working very hard to get him a big break. They made a film at the beginning of 69 called Love You Till Tuesday, which was largely rehashing songs from the first album, and Bowie was sort of miming to them on screen and, you know, doing little routines to them. It's quite a low-budget little thing. It's utterly charming, but, you know, very much of its time. But for this film, Bowie wrote a new song called Space Oddity. and they recorded the first version of it, the beginning of 69. And the original version of it, which appears in that film, is definitely a tryout. It's nowhere near as polished and remarkable a thing as the famous recording that we all know, which came later in the year. It was recorded in June at the beginning of the album sessions. But elsewhere on the album, there are bits and bobs of other things. You know, it's one of those. There are other David Bowie albums, incidentally, quite a few others that are dominated by one famous song, aren't there? I mean, Heroes, you might say, is another. Absolutely. What a wonderful album, full of wonderful songs, but Heroes is the one that everybody, you know, obsesses over, and it sort of dominates the album, almost to the detriment of the rest of the album. Yeah. You know, you need to go
kind
and
of listen.
Yeah, that's right. And the Space Oddity album is a case in point with that, because obviously this great, monolithic, brilliant, remarkable song opens the album. And then there's all the other stuff that comes after, which I love. But Space Oddity is actually the sort of the least representative track on the album. The rest of it hangs together better than, I think.
I think so. I mean, the rest of it, it rather reminds me of with Please Please Me and 13 other songs.
Yeah.
It's got that big hit. But Space Oddity was, and certainly by Tony Visconti, was seen as being a novelty. I mean, I think Tony Visconti refused, and by this point Visconti and Bowie's relationship was maybe a couple of years old, but when it came to this song, Visconti thought it was a misstep.
Yes.
And he thought this is not the direction you should be going in. So,
well, I think it speaks a little bit about how idealistic everybody was at this point. Everybody in this circle. Bowie was very idealistic at this point. He was involved in this arts laboratory movement that he co-founded with some friends of his in Beckenham, and they were very into, you know, art for art's sake and doing their thing. And Tony Visconti was also very, you know, and so yes, I think the reason that Tony declined to do that song was, you know, he said that Bowie was producing such beautiful music, and then he came out with a song which, as far as Visconti was concerned, was a bit of a cheap shot to cash in on the forthcoming moon landing, which of course in a way it kind of was. I think what maybe Tony didn't kind of quite twig at that point, and of course he did later, because he then later said how, you know, he wished he'd got off his high horse, and because obviously it was a classic, is that it's a song about a spaceman, but it plugs into all of David Bowie's key themes of alienation and emotional disconnection, and it's not a science fiction novelty hit about a spaceman that's got something to do with that Kubrick film and that Apollo landing. Of course it is all of those things too, but it's actually a sort of text David Bowie lyric, and I think it is, you know, even after all these years and after everything else and after all those other amazing songs that came later, there's a sense in which Space Oddity remains his most remarkable song. The economy of the lyric, you know, it's not a fiddly Baroque sort of Rococo lyric. It's very plain, but there is so much in it. He crams so much nuance into every, there are lines in there that resonate right across his career. You know, the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. That's a line that you could unpack forever about Bowie's preoccupation with the media, and, you know, the way that people, you know, that's the first thing that they say to Major Tom as he takes off, is the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. So it's about fashion, it's about celebrity, it's about media intrusion. You know, you can think of other lines, you know, put a bullet in my brain and it makes all the papers is another famous line from a Bowie song that he actually wrote quite young and then ended up recording on Scary Monsters later. So there's those papers again. And I think of a thing like the video for The Stars Are Out Tonight, where he's looking at celebrity papers and Ziggy Stardust songs like Star, and it goes on and on and on. So that's all in that line, is all there already. And a line like, I think my spaceship knows which way to go, that's extraordinary. I mean, there's a sort of philosophical heft to that line. It's such a plain line, but it's about predestination and, you know, that old existentialism versus determinism chestnut. You know, it's an extraordinarily complicated song about free will and about loneliness and about action and inaction. It's almost a sort of a Hamlet soliloquy. I mean, it's truly, well, images and ideas and that he would return to over and over again. And yes, clearly this sort of lost spaceman shtick. Yeah. It doesn't have to always be Major Tom. It doesn't have to be the same character. But that idea of a lost soul out there in another world or on another plane that's obviously something that really, really spoke to him.
He himself would always be joking about, especially following the man who fell to Earth, I always get scripts to play aliens or
Martians
or things.
Yeah.
You know, that space metaphor never quite left him. It was always very integral to
the
Bowie myth, almost. Yeah. You know, spaceman, Ziggy, outer space, everything.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, what you can read into that is, well, you know, move into his love of Buddhism, which I think was very influential around the time of writing or recording Space Oddity. The tail end of the hippie movement. I mean, 1969 was a strange year. 1969 was the year of almost like the party coming to an end.
That's right. And of course, that's exactly what happens at the end of this album. But yes. maybe we're jumping ahead of ourselves here. But the final song on the album is exactly about that particular period of artistic and moral and intellectual naivety sort of coming to an end and moving on to something that was actually slightly more, let's get to grips with reality, guys. You know,
you're talking about Memory of a Food Festival, which combines these lyrics, which, I mean, I've always felt there's a sheer blast of euphoria in this song. The guitar lines, you know, the blatant Beatles
the big sort of sing along, the sort of Hey Jude, All You Need Is Love type thing.
Lyrics, I don't know, because you're saying that this was the, you know, that this was the sort of an acknowledgement of failure, whereas I would feel that Signet Committee was the song.
Oh, I think they both. Yes, Signet Committee is a much angrier song, definitely. Yeah. No question about that. Signet Committee is a diatribe, isn't it? About, well, all sorts of things. Mm. I mean, that's lyrically almost the opposite of Space Oddity. It's incredibly ornate. It goes on all over the place, and it's got extraordinary digressions into weird... Yeah, and the words just keep on coming.
This was the album that lumbered him... Well, not lumbered, he acknowledged, but no, the British Dylan...
Yes.
I mean, we even get a name check in the Love Machine London
That's right. Road, but That's right.
Apparently Ken Pitt had said to him afterwards, look, you're getting too Dylan, and he responded very emotionally to that.
That's right, yeah.
But
well,
you can't write something like Signet Committee and then get upset when people compare you to Dylan.
Exactly, yeah.
It is his Desolation Road.
It certainly is. It's very interesting. I think one of the things about this album is that I think we can hear on it that Bowie hasn't yet... He's still looking for his own personal... I hesitate to say authentic, because that's not a good word to use in relation to Bowie, I don't think. Not that he was inauthentic, but that artifice was part of his thing. But his own individual voice, you know, he was a great mimic. And at this stage in his career, he hadn't yet honed in on and perfected that sort of very distinctive Bowie voice that we start to hear on Hunky Dory and on Ziggy Stardust, you know. And he's still sort of experimenting with different vocal possibilities, using his voice as an instrument as much as any of the other instruments, you know. So yes, there's a Dylan... affectation on some of the tracks, but there's also on other tracks. I mean, Space Oddity is actually, you know, I'm not the first person to say this, there's a definite echo of the Bee Gees in that song, the New York mining disaster, that sort of and if you listen to the Hermione songs on the album, which is something else we haven't talked about yet, but you know, Letter to Hermione and An Occasional Dream, there's a kind of almost an Art Garfunkel thing, or maybe even a Jose Feliciano thing going on there. People who were very big at the time. And of course on Janine, another fabulous track on there, he's doing Elvis. They're not exactly pastiches. He's just sort of using little bits of people he admired as palette, you know, colours on his palette, and having a go, seeing how that worked. The nearest we hear to what feels to me like Bowie himself really talking to us on this album. I'm probably going to change my mind, you know, as soon as we finish. I'm going to regret saying this, but I think that we start to hear it on a song like Wild Eyed Boy from Free Cloud, and maybe on Memory of a Free Festival as well. But yeah, going back to that one, you see that it is a very positive song. It's Memory of a Free Festival. It's beautiful and it's very uplifting and everything. But I think it's personally, and this is just my opinion, I think it's a slight misreading to see that song as just a sort of paean to hippie, lovely, passed around the dope and everyone had a lovely time that day. I don't think it's really that. It's the Children of the Summer's End, and it's a memory of a free festival. We claimed the very source of joy ran through. It didn't, but it seemed that way. You know, and so he's being quite realistic about sort of, you know, that was fun. Yeah. We can actually continue.
There's a
know.
Distance, isn't there?
Yeah.
There's a slight sort of shrugging of like, well, you know, that was great then, and, you know, it's a few months ago, and we're all a little bit older now, and we're a bit wiser.
Exactly, yeah. So I think it's the sort of softer... It's a far, far softer way of saying some of the similar things that he says on the Signet Committee,
I mean, by all accounts, when the actual Free Festival took place, which was in summer...
69. It was right in the middle of the album sessions.
It was an event that Bowie himself had been very instrumental in organising in Beckenham.
It was on the same day, the same weekend as Woodstock, you know. The second day of Woodstock was happening on when that Free Festival was... Yeah.
Zoom quickly over the planet down to South London, and there this bunch of very earnest, long-haired... young hippies were doing their thing.
Yeah.
And Bowie himself had returned recently from Italy or Malta.
He'd been abroad, to both,
to the death of his father, which really hit him hard, and by all accounts he was in an absolutely vile mood that day.
Yes.
Just kind of ironic when, you know, he's looking back
with rose-tinted that's right, yes, apparently he was in a foul mood that day, but he certainly sort of turned that feeling around when he came to write the song. But of course, yes, I mean, it's very, you know, there are of course all of these eyewitness accounts from people who were there who said this, and it's a very interesting story, but I think ultimately you can't, as you've just said, you know, good heavens, he'd buried his father about 5 days earlier, so I think he was allowed to be in a bad mood.
But I think he was one of the first artists that I've heard of that really, in song, began skewering the hippie.
Yes, yes.
Blue. Because of course then later on that year we have Altamont, we have,
yes,
you know, all these...
And that really was the...
Yeah, exactly. We have the Beatles disintegration, all these things that 1969 so conveniently occurring at the end of the decade,
yes, yes,
managed to bring us.
Yes.
And I think Signet Committee and Free Festival are both very sharp analyses in their own way of this of the delusion, you know, the self delusion of this utopia.
In Signet Committee, there's a lot more anger as well. So there are direct targets. You know, he's talking about, you know, the sort of people who are exploiting this idealism for their own ends, and he's talking about people who are misguided. He's talking about the stupidity of following dodgy leaders and doctrinaires, which of course is another great Bowie theme that would carry on right through. You know, it's a whole string of songs across, well, Ziggy Stardust and on Diamond Dogs, and, you know, Somebody Up There Likes Me on Young Americans, songs about dangerous leaders and the temptation to follow them. Indeed, yes, which again, of course, is a hugely topical subject, sadly, even today, especially today.
Do you think that, had any other artist made a major statement like this before? I can't think off the top of my head. I mean, certainly people like, say, Lennon in his Plastic Ono Band album was an entire repudiation.
Indeed. And that's a little bit later, isn't it? That's later, 70.
That's definitely at least a year later. But had anyone else really made such as bitter a damnation of the hippie dream?
It's interesting. I don't honestly know if they have. I'm sure someone will write in and tell us that they did. But I'm not aware of anything of that level of... I mean, the bile of Signet Committee is something quite... unprecedented at the time for Bowie, and I'm not even sure if there's anything after it either that comes up to that. I mean, he's absolutely there. I will fight for the right to be right, and I'll kill for the good of the fight for the right to be right. And he's, of course, singing that ironically. That's someone saying it in his song. And, you know, this is vicious stuff. And he was very disillusioned with what he'd seen and with some of the people that he'd been hanging out with. It's a brilliant song, and it's a very hard song to talk about because it's so complex, musically very complex as well. He never really did anything quite like that again.
I always hear that song, and I hear it being done in a take, and I hear rather like the musicians with Dylan would do on Blonde on Blonde, be looking at him for a cue, and then just lurch into the next bit, but picking up on the emotion, picking up on the intensity, picking up on what must have been an amazing... But if it was indeed a single take thing, which I always have fancied, just because of that emotion can't be faked, and it would be very hard to be dropping in and out of But absolutely wonderful. And this is a really good moment to mention who was playing with him here. So here we have Junior's Eyes.
Yes.
They were a shit-hot session band. So we had Tim Renick, I think, on guitar.
That's right. And Don Lodge on bass.
And...
Who there are various other people on the there's actually quite a lot of people on the album, but Terry Cox and John Cambridge were on drums.
Terry Cox on the album.
That's right, I believe so. Yes, he was in Pentangle, wasn't he? And and there were a number of different guitarists on it, but Mick Wayne was the guitarist on Space Oddity, on the song Space Oddity. Yeah, played that wononderful takeoff. Okay, you know, that's a real unsung bit of guitar. And of course, another great musician on this album is Rick Wakeman. That's right. He plays the Mellotron on Space Oddity, which was apparently only his first or second ever session. He played the organ down in a top ranked ballroom somewhere or something, and Tony Visconti had heard of him from somewhere, called him in, and you know, within a year or not much more than a year. Rick Wakeman was, you know, he was off with the Straubs and then with, you know, playing with it. And of course, everyone knows that Rick Wakeman played on Hunky Dory. He plays all those wonderful ornate piano parts.
Well, he is to Hunky Dory what Mike Garson is to Aladdin.
Right,
Sam,
exactly,
he?
Exactly he's that. The, yeah, but yes, his first entree to Bowie is on Space Oddity. So yeah, no, it was a great band. Tim Renwick's guitar is a very idiosyncratic. You know, you can recognise it a mile away, can't you? It's got that wonderful sound that's very characteristic. Yeah, I think it's a great band on this album. You know, very, very underrated musically, really. And Bowie was playing bits and bobs himself. Bowie, of course, plays that wonderful, deliberately hesitant and strange Rosedale chord organ thing at the beginning of Memory of a Free Festival.
That's him. Yeah,
that's Bowie picking it out. That's great, because he was just beginning to... He hadn't historically played keyboards very much. By the time we got to Hunky Dory, he was composing songs on the piano, songs like Oh You Pretty Things and Life on Mars. He was playing piano to, you know... He then, of course, gave Life on Mars to Rick Wakeman, who was a far more proficient pianist than pretty much anyone, actually. But certainly
on one of the 5 years documentaries, which obviously you were involved with, Rick Wakeman is on there marvelling
at
the chord structures.
Yes, that's right. Rick Wakeman has always, rightly, you know, paid great tribute to... Bowie's extraordinary talent as a songwriter was partly from his extraordinary free imagination, but also partly from a complete lack of formal musical training. I mean, he had a few saxophone lessons and a few guitar lessons, and that's it, you know, as a teenager. So it's a combination of those two things that Bowie sort of wasn't afraid to come up with a chord progression that any classically trained musician would have said, what on earth? But as Rick Wakeman so eloquently explained in the 5 years documentary, yes, that's what makes Life on Mars, extraordinary modulations that no one else, nobody but David Bowie would have come up with.
But coming back to Space Oddity, so we had this wonderful band, we had Junior's Eyes, and he threw quite a lot at them. So after the title track, which you said Mick Wayne played lead on, was kind of like a slight anomaly in the lineup, being produced by Gus Dudgeon and sort of, as we discussed earlier, occupying its own colossal universe.
Yes,
so
yes.
I've always loved Unwashed and Somewhat Slightly Dazed.
Goodness me, what a track.
Which is just this frenetic, chaotic, hectic Bo Diddley meets Bob Dylan in Beckenham.
You've got
this crazy shuffling beat. And I mean, what do you think? I've always thought this is about Hermione. It's about that.
Yes.
You know, his insecurities about his relationship with this very aristocratic, very elegant...
That's certainly what it sounds like, isn't it? No, I'm always hesitant to pin any Bowie song down to saying it's about this and that's what it's about.
Well, as a starting
the end.
Point.
But that is definitely that's a resonance, clearly, isn't it? It appears to be a song about a boy who is, as you say, insecure about the way he's perceived by his girlfriend and her family. But again, it goes off into these extraordinary, vicious, spitting, angry things. Yeah. And my head's full of murders where only killers scream. And then he rushes. I got eyes in my backside. And there's it gets quite trippy, doesn't it? There's what happens to the Brack painting? It seeps down his front or something. I can't remember. It is an extraordinary song and very, I mean, just fantastically catchy as well. I mean, yes, that Bo Diddley syncopation isn't anything terribly sophisticated, but it's great. And of course, a wonderful harmonica solo by Benny Marshall, who was a member of a band called The Rats, who Mick Ronson had.
Yes.
Indeed, of course.
So
now Mick Ronson, that's right. Mick Ronson is not on the scene yet, but he was one of the people. He was in his orbit who, you know, was one of the reasons why Mick Ronson would soon after be introduced to David Bowie. It's Dylan with a rocket up it, though, isn't it? It really is. It's a fantastic song. It's got a real energy and a real feel. I think these, and it's quite long as well. Quite a lot of the songs on this album are quite long. It hasn't got that many tracks on it because Signer Committee and Unwashed and Somewhat Slightly Dazed and Memory of a Free Festival are all pretty long songs.
But this was 1969. People were making long songs.
Yeah, right, yes.
At this point, wasn't it?
Yes. It's another interesting thing about the sort of... slightly scattergun nature of this album, that yes, some of these things are you know, long 9 minute tracks. I think Signer Committee is the longest one, is about 9.5 minutes, but then there are other ones that are only a couple of minutes long, 2 or 3 minutes long. The two soft, quiet sort of love songs to Hermione are both quite short numbers and very different creatures. And then there's a real oddity, which is a song that I love, and it's perhaps the most overlooked song on the album, a song called God Knows I'm Good, which again has that sort of Bo Diddley, and now there's a funny little moment. Not a song that I suppose anyone would pick as a defining moment of David Bowie. But it's
again, like with Never Been Down, you pick the song I really. I mean, I have to admit, I'm not a huge fan of Wide Eyed Boy from Fleetwood. But God knows I'm good about, you know, the lady stealing a tin of stewing steak, and I don't know, they're just it's banal. It's ridiculous. And then God knows I'm good. How many times is this?
I think it's a really interesting song. It's probably the least song on the album.
It's a really interesting little one.
Don't Sit Down. No. There's a classic.
There's a stone-cold classic.
That's a little bit of studio horseplay, isn't it? Which actually, that's interesting in itself. That sort of prefigures some of that sort of studio nonsense that you hear on Hunky Dory, Andy Warhol and all that. There's a bit of little mucking about bits. So that's quite fun. That's right. But I think what's interesting about God Knows I'm Good, apart from the fact that it is clearly, perhaps more so than any of the other songs, that is quite a hippie song. That is quite a sort of, hey man, you know.
Consumerism, yeah, cash machines.
That's right, yeah.
The man,
absolutely. Yeah. But it is probably just about the beginning of a little preoccupation of Bowie's, which is with machines. You know, the cash machine was spitting at her shoulder. Now, machine is one of those words, if you start looking through Bowie's oeuvre, that just pops up over and over again. And he had this sort of thing about the mechanisation of society and the dehumanising effect of the man or of society. There are machines elsewhere on this album. There's a Love Machine, Number Three, Desolation Row, and so on. There's also, if you look through his career, there's Saviour Machine. He formed a band called Tin Machine, and Praying to the Light Machine. Machines just come up the whole time, and this is kind of the beginning of it. He's got this thing about this cash machine spitting at this poor old lady
who's the lone individual in this increasingly mechanised, caring, cold society. You put a very interesting light onto it. I mean, to me, God Knows I'm Good is a filler. It's a track which is a rather weak sort of, and it's again coming sandwiched between tracks like Signal Committee and Free Festival. This rather sort of naive, like, hey man, machines are bad.
Yeah.
Consumerism is killing us. Like this little old lady just wants something to eat.
Okay.
To me, exactly. Yeah. It's like a bit like, hey, come on.
Yeah.
And that's why it didn't quite ring true. And then to me, again, the extended coda of the title repeated over.
Yes.
Was really the sound of like, okay, guys, somebody step in here and put him out of his mouth. This is just too much.
But I think it's such a hit. I'm quite sure that he really, really means it, though. Mm. You know, I don't think it's... I think it's... This is actually something else about this album. A lot of Bowie's work over the years, we can look at it and say there is an element of irony to this. A huge element of irony, quite often. I think a lot of this album is actually much more naked than that. I don't think he's sort of curling his lip, and you know, in that ironic way, in Signal Committee, or in God Knows I'm Good. I think he really, really means it. I think it's a much rawer. I mean, obviously, and the Hermione songs, which we haven't really talked about at all yet. They are among the most personal songs that he ever put on an album. You know, later on in his career, he very much stepped back from, you know. As he himself said, he wasn't an artist who got up on stage and told you what sort of a day he'd just had. It was not about that. It was about the theatre, and it was about the characters, and it was about the... But those two songs are absolutely straight-up songs of regret for a relationship that had just ended, and, you know, a real relationship. And he names his former lover in the title of one of them. They're very beautiful. I think they're very, very beautiful songs. And again, this is a very young man laying himself bare. You know, I think they are really, really very, very beautiful songs. Hermione Farthingale actually did me the very great honour of getting in touch with me a few years ago, as she did with a couple of other people who'd written about Bowie, and we had some. Some lovely conversations. She was, you know, she famously had been, you know, vanished from the face of the earth for many, many years. And to many people, she had become the enigma of, you know, and you know, it had got to the stage that she just felt that maybe she should just put a few things straight, because a few myths had built up about all sorts of just crazy stuff. There was this story that she'd gone off to become a cartographer, charting the rivers of Borneo or something, which she was very keen to tell me was an absolute load of old codswallop, but she, you know, she spoke very, very fondly about those songs, and said, and particularly in Occasional Dream, she said she thought it was a beautiful song, and it really spoke to her, because, you know, they were just a young couple who had, you know, shared something wonderful for a little while, and then they split up, and you know, I don't know about you, but that pretty much happened to me when I was 18, and it happens to everyone. I'll tell you something about An Occasional Dream as well. Of course, it's about that, But it's also that introduces a theme which is rampages through Bowie's career. It's about time. You know, he's singing Time, An Occasional Dream. I Keep a Photograph. It burns my wall with time. What a line. What a line for a... Time is waiting in the wings. Yeah. Time takes a cigarette. Exactly. Pretty soon now you're going to get older. Yeah. Soon there'll be nothing left of me. All of these, you know, let's drink to that in the passing time. That's not one of his, of course. That was a cover version. But this was a something. Yeah, even as a youngster, he was already thinking of, you know, intimations of mortality are a, that's a major, you know, flag in all of Bowie's work. And that song is quite a, it's a beautiful song, and it's a touching song. It's actually quite a chilling song as well. I think, and again, I don't want to put on my amateur psychoanalyst hat and start saying silly things, but I think we can safely say that this album generally is quite a, it's a sad album. Mm. I think that Bowie was quite a troubled young man at this point. You know, I mean, I don't mean in some ridiculously melodramatic way, but he was going through a lot. His father, as we've said, died halfway through the making of the album as well. He'd just had this relationship which had ended, and he was very disillusioned with a lot of the things that were going on around him, and all of this poured into the album. And I think we are hearing songs written by someone who's, you know, going through an awful lot of shit.
It's a very perplexed album. There's a lot of confusion there. And you're bringing me to, ironically, a song which wasn't originally included in the album, but has since been appended to it, which I think must be amongst my favourite David Bowie
songs. Oh, is this Conversation piece? Yes. Yeah, wow.
Which articulates, encapsulates everything you just said there.
Yeah. That's as close to being a song about, well, or, you know, sung by a character who is suffering from depression as one could get to. I think it really, yes, it is indeed an absolutely beautiful song, which of course many, many years later he revisited in his sessions for his Toy album.
I really love that version.
Yes, it's a very beautiful song, and yes, it's a deeply sad little song. And again, the concept of time and the concept of the impermanence, that's another Bowie sort of preoccupation, of course.
The Buddhist
preoccupations
at this point.
I think perhaps the key line in Conversation piece, I mean, it's heartrending, but he sings, "I'm invisible and dumb, and no one will recall me. What a thing to to have going through your head. But yes, the dread of, you know, oblivion, that's a word that comes up, isn't it, in the Bewley Brothers and elsewhere, and impermanence comes up in Changes, of course, A Stream of Warm Impermanence, and in After All, he sings about impermanence as well. This is something that clearly preoccupied him, the fleetingness, absolutely,
the ephemeral nature of existence, yeah.
And it's not about, I want to be famous, I want everyone to listen to me and buy my records. It's not as trivial as that. It's about the... inherent futility of existence. There's something very deeply rooted about how any of us are going to be known or understood at all on any level, or whether we are at any, you know. And again, for this very young man to be writing these extraordinary songs. I agree with you. A conversation piece, which was recorded during the album sessions. I mean, you know, we might well say, goodness knows why that didn't end up on the album, and God knows I'm good, did. But hey,
Why do you think that song did not end up on the album? Such a miniature gem, such an encapsulation of, like you say, depression. The lines in that song where he perfectly articulates a very depressed mind of, he's invisible and dumb, and he can't see the bridge for the rain in my eyes. You know, the heart-rending lines about living above a sweet old Austrian man.
That's right.
Who tries to be a friend, but anyone, I believe, who suffered from depression will identify with this feeling of, and to bring in another Bowieism, being stuck behind a glass wall.
Yes.
Where the world takes place outside you and you just stand helpless.
Yes.
And even lines like my essays, lines scattered on the floor.
Fulfill their needs just by being there. Yeah.
But what a beautiful...
Yeah.
Miniature, precise distillation.
It really is.
How the hell wasn't this on the album?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? It's interesting how, you know, who knows? We can only conjecture. I mean, one possibility is that the song was simply too personal for him. That's one possibility. Another possibility is perhaps he looked at the overall spread of the album and thought that was going to be one too many self-pitying. You know, he already had Letter to Hermione and An Occasional Dream, and maybe he just thought enough is enough, you know. And, I mean, this is something that happens quite often across his career again. You know, we could look at, I mean, when that extraordinary Ziggy Stardust outtake, Sweethead, first came to light a good few years ago now, a lot of people said, what on earth, why wasn't that on the album instead of It Ain't Easy or something? Yeah. You know, but again, perhaps the reason was that it was, he looked at the overall mix and thought, no, we've already got quite a lot of those fast rocker, hang on to yourself type songs, and maybe that's just one too many. And maybe, again, it refers to Ziggy as well, doesn't it, in the song? So, and who's maybe not wanting to put all his eggs in one basket. But anyway, there are all sorts of reasons can are possible. But yeah, it is intriguing, isn't it? Yeah. Intriguing that Conversation piece was sidelined. It came out as a B-side, but to the next single after the album. But yes, I think it's a real sort of neglected jewel, one of his greatest early songs.
Telling, I think, that he revisited this when he was putting together what became the Toy sessions, and that version, I think, wasn't it on a CD single?
Yes, it was released as a bonus track with Heathen. Because some of the songs from the Toy sessions, yes, did eventually come out around about Heathen and Reality Time, were put out as bonus tracks or B-sides,
And it slowed down to a crawl, and his voice now is weathered and deep and sonorous.
And it brings a whole new, different type of regret to it. It's not a young man's neurosis, it's an old man's regret. Middle-aged man's regret. It feels like it's the same song, but it suddenly has all sorts of different echoes. Yeah.
An amazing song, absolutely amazing song. What shall we say about Wide Eyed Boy from Free Cloud?
Wild Eyed.
Wild
Eyed. That's what we'll say about it. It is
wild. Sorry, not the wide eyed.
The wide eyed.
Wild. One glass of wine. The wide. Wild.
The wide wild.
The wide wild. This is awful.
Should we start again?
Okay. What should we say about the wild-eyed boy from Free Cloud, complete with the lush orchestration?
Yeah, of course, two versions of that song. Gus Dudgeon produced the version that was the B-side of the Space Oddity single, which is quite pared down and just has a cello on it, and played by the fabulous Paul Buckmaster, who did some of the arrangements on the album. But yes, when it came to the album version, Tony Visconti put together a 50-piece orchestra and wrote this extraordinary piece, and it's extraordinary. There's, you know, brass and woodwind and strings, and it's a real sort of production number. It's one of, I think it's the most elaborate piece of, you know, arranging and producing on the album, and it's a real showpiece. And I think it's one of the first recordings that really steps up to the plate and does justice to the ambition of Bowie's songwriting. You know, I suppose you could say the same about Space Oddity, actually, the song Space Oddity. You know, that's another one. I think it's a very interesting song. I think it's a very lovely song. I think one of the things that's interesting about it is that it's, again, it's one of the first of its type, and they come on again and again through Bowie's career. It's a song about some sort of a messiah, isn't it? You know, in this instance, it's a sort of wild boy who's been brought up by nature, by the mountain, and he's misunderstood by the villagers who want to put him to death for being a sort of strange, suspect character.
Standard.
Yeah, that old suggests
that old. He comes down from the mountain and says he's got a gun.
Yes, that's right. And it's, you know, it taps into something that had a certain currency at the time. I think there was in the late 60s hippie period, there was a little moment of fascination with this idea of the sort of noble savage was a sort of thing that was resurrected. I mean, you know, for one thing, there was Disney's Jungle Book came out in 67, you know, so you've got Mowgli there in the public consciousness, and there was a new translation which had come out a few years earlier of a book about the wild boy of Aviron, is it, in France, a famous case
from the
wolf boy, exactly, yes. And that had become a bit of a thing that, you know, it was one of those books like Jonathan Livingston Seagull that all the hippies were reading. So the idea of this sort of feral boy raised by wolves or whatever it was a kind of a thing at the time. So I don't know if Bowie was tapping into that, but I think we can suggest that he probably was. It was definitely in the air. So that's interesting. But yes, you know, it's almost a precursor to Ziggy Stardust or something like that, in the sense that it's a sort of strange, charismatic guru stroke messiah figure who comes to grief because the rest of the world doesn't get it.
Exactly.
That's
a very interesting point, actually. It is almost a proto Ziggy.
Yeah.
Isn't
it? It's not the same story at all, but it's
not quite a leper messiah, it's still this or even you could stretch a bit like a sort of almost like a Thomas Jerome Newton, or, you know, like this extraterrestrial or outer space character comes yes. and is then mauled by the villagers.
That's right, exactly that. And it's almost got a sense of that sort of, old Frankenstein movies, that sort of thing, you know, the torch-bearing villagers. But also has just beautiful, beautiful lyrics. You know, this is, I know we've sort of pulled a couple of lyrics out of the air in the course of this discussion, but all the way through this album, there are lines that are just remarkable. The hangman plays the mandolin before he goes to sleep. Yeah. There's a line, isn't it? I mean, there's a line to conjure
with. It's like a fairy tale, isn't it? You know, just like you visualise it through. And he has a wonderful sense of place and of setting and of mise-en-scène.
Yes.
And that's the theatrical flair that he has, the hangman plays the mandolin before he goes to sleep. There's always these little touches just being put in just to set the scene there for you
a
little bit more. Yeah. Very, very visual.
Yes, that's right. And it's real word painting. I think it's a very, very beautiful song. You said it's not really one of your favourites?
Not really one of my favourites, no. I mean, I can appreciate completely what you like about it. But I don't know, I think for me on this album, aside from the title track, which we agree sort of occupies a certain space, Free Festival Conversation Piece isn't on the album as such. It's actually, I think, a track as simple as Janine is something I would go back to again and again, just because of the exuberance, the simplicity, the exuberance, and the weirdness.
Yes, it's got a wonderful lyrics. Wallop to it, that song. And now, there's another case in point. Of course, those who are looking through Bowie's early work to find, you know, samples of what might follow on. Of course, there's rich pickings in Janine. If you take an axe to me, you'll kill another man. Not me at all. Yeah. Again, what an extraordinary thing for a man of those youthful years to write. But of course, that factors into all of that mask wearing and artifice later on.
Yeah.
And of course, I want an axe to break the ice. Want to come? You know, these. You know. Just little echoes the all the way through. Yeah. There are lines in that song. I mean. Your strange demand to collocate my mind scares me into gloom. These are remarkable. Yeah. I mean, I think I know what he's saying, but it's what an extraordinary way to say it.
Your strange demand to collocate my mind.
And of course, I mean, no one really knows exactly what he's going on about in that song. We do know that it was the Janine in question was the girlfriend of his old school friend George Underwood, who designed some of the cover artwork, the back cover artwork for the Space Oddity album, and various other things for George Underwood, of course, the boy who famously in a schoolboy fight many years before punched David Bowie in the face, apparently with very good reason, and gave him his famous wonky eye. But Janine was George's girlfriend, I think Bowie said at the time that he said, I just wrote this about his girlfriend because I thought this was how George should have seen her. Right. And George Underwood has since said, I honestly have no idea what he was on about. He liked her very much. He was always very nice to her. It's not a... Because it's a weird song. I'm not sure if he's being, you know... Is it a sort of catty song, or is it actually quite an affectionate song? It's a very strange song, anyway. But that's Bowie down to a T, isn't it? That's Bowie all over. It's intriguing, and you can take it in so many different ways. You know,
his childhood friend is going, I haven't a clue. Yeah, he's written that my girlfriend. Is he after it?
Yes.
What was he trying to say? It has this wonderful simplicity. I think again, coming after the huge storm and drang of Signet Committee.
Yes.
You know, and this incredible draining. Experience just listening, presenting the song. This is like, you know, when the Queen is Dead by the Smiths, when you have Cemetery Gates
at
the end of side one after, you know, I know it's over.
Yeah.
And, you know, and just these incredibly sapping songs. And again, it's like a shaft of sunlight. You don't know what he's going on about, but it's like a ray of sunshine coming.
Yes.
That version, especially, I think, has got an added bounce and kick to it, which. What we've been talking about on this album is that, you're right, it's a downbeat album, it's an introspective album, it's an uncertain album, it's an album filled with doubts, with self-pity, with reflection, but this song, I think, is just that moment of just joy and redemption coming through, and I think that's one of the reasons why it makes this such a lovely album. I really, really genuinely love this album very much.
Yeah, yeah. No, me too. Opinion differs about whether this should be regarded as the first sort of, you know, classic good hanging together proper David Bowie album, or whether we should save that for the man who sold the world. I think it works David really well as an album. Well, I mean, actually, I'm a huge lover of the first album, the Decca. I love that album to pieces, but that's another story for another time. But so they're all great as far as I'm concerned. But yes, I think this album is, even though it is so disparate and so bitty, that in a way is its character.
That's its appeal. Again, Nick, thank you so much for your time.
It's been my pleasure.
Absolute pleasure talking about Space Odyssey here with you today. And we thoroughly recommend you check this album out again.
Yeah, definitely.
Enjoy. Oh, done.
Excellent.
Wow, thank you.
That was all right, wasn't it? I think we got through some stuff there.
And that was me and Nicholas Pegg talking about Space Oddity. And I really want to thank Nick Pegg for a wonderful conversation and for being such a generous co-conversationalist. And also, thanks to Nadi Shireen for giving us a place to record in. This podcast is going to be followed by another one next week, in which we'll be talking about another David Bowie album with another super person. So I hope you can join us. Till then, thanks for listening. Take care. Do like and subscribe this podcast if you can. It would make me incredibly happy. And I look forward to uploading the next edition of Album to Album very soon indeed.